MacCast, Tuesday, May 2nd, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we're going to have a good show for you today. We've got quite a few things to get into, including Apple's second quarter earnings call. That happened today, and there were some interesting numbers that came out of it. I'm going to say generally positive, but we'll get into all the details in just a minute. We're also going to be getting into more iPhone 8 leaks, of course, some updates on what Apple might have planned for entertainment content, video content, at least within Apple Music, and a little update on Apple Pay. There may be some changes coming there and some pretty good ones that I'm a little bit excited about, and also a new Mac malware to discuss, along with some Siri things and a few odds and ends, little bits here and there. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback. We're going to dig in more on the mysterious case of weird location data, something that we started on the last episode of the MacCast. So we've got a follow-up to that. We'll talk about a little bit about Apple TVs and two-factor authentication, some Genius Bar advice, along with critters maybe lurking somewhere in one of your Apple devices. And we'll elaborate on that more at the end of the show. But that's going to kind of round it out. Before we get into everything, though, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Blue Apron. I have to tell you, we are loving Blue Apron. It is a wonderful food service. It's, in fact, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. They've made it their mission to make incredible home cooking as accessible to everyone as possible. And they achieve that by supporting things like a more sustainable food system. They set the highest standards for their ingredients, and they're working on building a community of home chefs. And we've been enjoying Blue Apron meals for a while now, and I am eating better than ever, I have to be honest. And what we love is the variety. They let you pick your own choices from a variety of menus every week, and in fact, the recipes are not repeated within a year, so you're not going to get bored. You're always getting to try new things, and the quality and freshness of the ingredients has been amazing. In fact, they even guarantee it. Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right, so they'll take care of you. And a huge advantage for us with Blue Apron has been undoing the, and you probably have this as well, the what are we going to make for dinner dilemma. It always comes up in our house, and we're always kind of going through, you know, our recipes, and yeah, I don't want that, I don't want to repeat that. You're not going to have that with Blue Apron. And another thing that's been amazing is the arrival of the Blue Apron shipment actually has become an event in our household, and you get to pick the day. So they allow you to fit that into your schedule, but it's like a day of excitement of what are we getting? What did we order? Of course we set that in advance, but sometimes you forget. And when it arrives, it's the unboxing experience is just really great. So it's even helping my kids become less picky eaters. I think I've talked about that, and we're becoming better cooks because we're learning about new flavors and things like that. We recently had Ila cannoli pasta and crispy oyster mushrooms with arugula and a marinated mozzarella salad. Yeah, it sounds as good as it actually was. And one of the wonderful things was we had never had oyster mushrooms before, and I discovered I love them. We're going to be probably using them in more recipes. As a matter of fact, my kids, they would never try mushrooms before. They tried these and they loved them. So we've introduced them to new foods, and that has been a wonderful advantage for our family. And because the meals come with step-by-step and easy-to-follow recipe cards with the list of ingredients right on there, we're actually expanding our family's meal choices. And we've already been remaking a lot of the meals, so it's expanding our dinner menu tremendously. And best of all, because you're a MacCast listener, you can try out Blue Apron for completely free. So if you haven't done it yet, check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free along with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/mattcast. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/mattcast. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And a big thank you to Blue Apron for the great meals and for supporting the Mattcast. Let's dig into Apple's second quarter 2017 earnings. The team sat down, they had their call today with investors and anyone who wanted to listen in, and the facts are pretty good. They made $52.9 billion in revenue with profits of about $11 billion. That compares with about $50.6 billion in revenue and $10.5 billion in profit for the same quarter last year. On the iPhone front, they sold 50.8 million iPhones. That is versus 51.1 million iPhones in the second quarter of 2016. They sold 8.9 million iPads, versus 10.1 million iPads in the second quarter of 2016, and 4.19 million Macs versus about 4 million in the same quarter last year. So revenues and profits were up slightly from the same quarter a year ago, with iPhone and iPad sales down a little bit and Macs pretty close to flat, but up, you know, a little bit, which was kind of surprising, although Tim Cook noted that that was largely due to the new MacBook Pros with the touch bars. And interestingly, iPhone revenue actually grew from $32.9 billion last year to about $33.3 billion this year, even though the actual unit sales numbers went down. And it's because of an increase in the average selling price of the iPhone. And Tim Cook even noted during the call that they had higher than expected demand for the iPhone 7 Plus, which is going to, you know, it's a little more of a premium priced phone, so that's going to add to that revenue bottom line. So iPhones and iPads, you know, iPads still going down and slumping, iPhones kind of remaining flat, and Macs up a little bit. A few other items of note, the services revenue was once again very good, over $7 billion, which kind of matched what they had last quarter, so they were able to maintain that, and that's actually up 18% year over year. And as a matter of fact, App Store revenue grew by 40% year over year. So the App Store doing very well. They added, I think, 26% more developers, so that continues to grow and be a good source of services revenue for Apple, of course, along with their subscription services, iCloud and Apple Music, which has been growing steadily. Apple Watch did very well. Apple doesn't give specific numbers on Apple Watch, but they did say that sales doubled year over year and that Apple Watch has an excellent customer satisfaction rating. And speaking of customer satisfaction, Apple's new AirPods, which also contributes to the other category of their revenue along with Apple Watch, has a 98% customer satisfaction rate. And Tim Cook kind of stated the obvious, Apple can't make them fast enough. You may or may not be aware that AirPods are still on about a six-week delivery time. So if you wanted to get your hands on some right now, it's still pretty difficult to get a hold of a pair. I absolutely love mine, so you can count me in that 98% of customers who are very satisfied with the AirPods. And Apple Watch and AirPods are part of that other category, which includes Beats headphones and Apple TV. Also, revenue in that category was actually up 31% year over year. So that's the kind of that, and services are kind of the big growth categories for Apple. And Apple ended the quarter with $256 billion of cash on hand, and 93% of that is actually outside of the U.S. So I think the U.S. is really hoping that Apple at some point will repatriate that money, but there's a lot of factors, obviously, that go into that, and we don't do politics on the Mattcast, so we won't get into that, but just something interesting of note. And then finally, they did mention that NPD data shows that iPad has about 81% of the share of the tablet market in the U.S. for tablets priced over $200. So they're kind of trying to, with that stat, a little bit diffuse the fact that iPad sales are slumping. And, you know, overall, this is okay in terms of the numbers. I think they kind of did a little bit better than guidance, but overall, kind of flat, not really a lot of excitement in this quarterly results call. Apple did their best to put a positive spin on it. For me, I'm going to call it kind of okay. The one thing I was thinking of as I was looking through these numbers and hearing all of the data coming out was that, you know, there really is one thing that Apple could probably do to really help increase sales and revenues. And I know that Tim Cook and the team already know this, but it's release new products. You know, they have to have new stuff to sell. It was expected with all the rumors that we were going to have new iPads by now. So, of course, iPads are slumping a bit. Apple doesn't have new models in the market. And whether or not, you know, we can debate whether or not even if they had new models, if iPad sales would have gone up in any significant way. I think they probably would. And so I say this with a little bit of seriousness, but also joking a little bit, because I think I much prefer that Apple releases products when they're ready to be released and not just on some sort of schedule so that they can get a bump in quarterly numbers. I think Wall Street and some analysts out there would prefer the latter, but I really think it's best that Apple releases products when and if they're ready and when it makes sense. And, you know, I'm willing to wait longer, even though as a fan, it tends to be a little bit frustrating. But overall, pretty good with the, or okay, I guess, with the quarterly numbers this time around. Of course, it's a new week, and we have more iPhone 8 or next generation iPhone rumors. I think I told you on the last show that I like the name iPhone Edition for the high end, the sort of 10th anniversary iPhone. But more and more, I think it's just going to be simply called the iPhone 8. But we got some more leaks this week, several coming through Twitter accounts and with images pulled off the Chinese website Weibo. It's kind of like I think it's been described to me as a cross, for those of you who maybe don't know what Weibo is, a cross between kind of Facebook and Twitter, social media website. A lot of leaks coming out of China start on that website. And one of the latest leaks is actually a schematic drawing. Of course, its authenticity cannot be verified, but it did show many of the same design elements that we've heard with other leaks. So seems to confirm a lot of what we've been expecting, that there's going to be a vertically oriented dual lens camera with a flash in the middle. The idea there being that Apple is looking to support some VR and augmented reality applications in the future. We've also heard about the 3D sensors, camera sensors that they're planning on using in this edition of the iPhone. So having a little more lens separation could help with that. And in the schematic, there's a large circular area that's kind of noted in the design, and that's possibly for where the wireless charging receiver would go. There's no Touch ID cutout, so that seems to further confirm the fact that Apple is pushing towards having an integrated in-glass sensor on the front, because most of the designs and rumors we've heard about to this point say that there's not going to be a physical Touch ID or home button on the front of the device. It's just going to be a solid sheet of glass. So that is actually one of the things that has led to the rumors that Apple may have the iPhone 8 in short supply, or they may actually have to delay the launch of the iPhone 8 because they've reportedly had some troubles with that technology and those components. And if you've heard previous episodes of the MacCast, you're probably already aware of that. But a later version of the schematic also surfaced with some additional callouts and labels, specifically labeling that inductive charging pad area as being a Qi design. That's Qi, pronounced Qi. And that is a open or a standard for wireless charging that a number of other phones have. So that got some people excited, thinking, well, maybe Apple is going to actually use the Qi standard. It doesn't necessarily mean that Apple will fully support the Qi standard. As a matter of fact, the Apple Watch uses a modified version of the Qi technology, so Apple could choose to go that route. Let's hope that they don't. I'd love it if it was a standardized design, but Apple may want to eke some more performance out of that, and maybe they've tweaked some things. So we're going to have to wait and see. But it's looking like wireless charging is going to be an option. The Lightning connector is still expected to be there, so you're going to have kind of the choice, and I think that's ultimately a good thing. Molds have also supposedly surfaced from the same sources that kind of back up these schematics, so it's looking like we're starting to dial in on what will be actually some of the final designs. It's been going back and forth. The reasons there has been mixed rumors, I think, in the past is that Apple has had, and they always do, have kind of multiple designs, and you know, as they're working on things, they never really know what the final specs are going to be until really they get almost to the point where they're going into production or are in production. Things always can change at the last minute. But it's looking like this is kind of the iPhone design we're going to end up with. And finally, a research note from Deutsche Bank claims that the iPhone 8 may not even ship this year. Now, I'm not putting much stock in this rumor. The information actually seems to come from a different supply chain rumor about packaging materials arriving for or being ordered only for two different iPhone models this year. The problem is that, or the reason I kind of don't believe this rumor or don't put much stock in it, is the fact that this is coming from just a single source. And Apple typically orders from multiple suppliers, not just one supplier. So I think there's maybe some mixed signals going on here. This is actually also the same information that was oddly interpreted by at least one site as evidence that Apple would be shipping just two iPhone 8 models this year, kind of contradicting the rumors we'd been hearing for a long time that Apple was going to release some updated iPhone 7S and 7S Plus models with the existing iPhone 7 designs, and then have this premium iPhone 8 model on the top end. So we're going to end up with three models of iPhones. I think that still is happening. And again, I think this is just misinterpretation of some of the data coming out of the supply chain, and something that Tim Cook has often warned sites and anybody talking about rumors about. And as a matter of fact, he was not very happy about, and I forgot to mention this earlier with respect to the quarterly results call, he was not very happy about the leaks coming out, and as a matter of fact, pointed at that out as a possible reason, or one of the reasons he believed that the iPhone sales numbers were not as good as they should have been, that people are kind of holding off and waiting based on rumors to find out what the next iPhone is going to be. And it's obviously way too early for that. If you're in the market for an iPhone right now, your best bet is to get one of the existing iPhone 7 models, because we're not going to have new iPhones until at least the fall, and maybe not even until 2018. So as I've always said with technology, Macs, iPhones, iPads, or otherwise, you buy them when you need them, and just get the best model that's available to you when you're ready to make your purchase, and don't kind of go off speculation, because otherwise you're going to keep waiting forever and ever. And even if Apple does have new iPhone 8 models out in the fall, it's expected that supplies are going to be incredibly constrained this time around. So your chances of even getting your hands on one early on is going to be tough. So don't wait around. Again, Tim Cook would prefer you didn't wait around. But that's kind of the latest on iPhone 8. We have a little more information on Apple Music and some of Apple's TV plans. Jimmy Iovine did a Bloomberg interview this past week, and in it he said that he's, quote, trying to help Apple Music become an overall movement in popular culture. This is a statement in line with some he made in interviews a few months back. He said those plans include everything from, quote, unsigned bands to video. Of course, he didn't go into any specific details about any new programming or what unsigned bands he was talking about, but he did mention possible projects and talked a little bit about who he's been talking to. He mentioned possibly a sequel to R. Kelly's rap opera, Trapped in the Closet, and he mentioned discussing ideas with Brian Grazer and J.J. Abrams. You know, reportedly, though, at least with the Grazer talks, they fizzled out. There was a report, you may remember, a while back that Apple was looking to possibly buy out Imagine Entertainment, which was a company co-founded by Grazer and Ron Howard, and those plans supposedly fell through. So The assumption is that what he was referring to was those talks. As far as what's going on with J.J. Abrams, who knows? I would absolutely love that. I'm a pretty big J.J. Abrams fan. So if he's going to make original content for Apple Music, that could be amazing, I really think. So I'm hoping that happens. But at this point, who really knows? Apple says they plan to, or Ivan said they plan to grow their video offerings slowly. And I think that's the right tact to take, kind of trying things out and bringing out things a little bit at a time. I think jumping in too quickly could be ultimately a bad thing for Apple. And supposedly the next version of the music app in iOS is going to be designed to better showcase some of these new video offerings. It's been said that Apple's lack of a consistent vision and message for video, though, has been holding it back when it's been in talks with different media companies and producers and things like that. We've heard rumors of Jimmy Iovine having meetings and kind of making arrangements for deals without really telling anyone, and that has supposedly frustrated some people at Apple, some of his colleagues and stuff like that. So he's been kind of known for, you know, being out there and kind of making a lot of promises and statements and saying a lot of things. Of course, I don't know him personally, so I'm only speaking based on the things that I've been reading. So who really knows? But it sounds like that's been some of the trouble that Apple's been having and kind of getting deals done. That, and I think there's a lot of hesitation and caution because it's Apple, you know, and they can kind of tend to take over a market. And I think sometimes people are a little bit gun shy, and there's a lot of competition going on between Amazon and Hulu and Netflix and everybody else who's involved in this. So, you know, I think Apple kind of taking the approach of rolling some of the early stuff into Apple Music and seeing where it goes, I think that's a good thing. For right now, we only know about a few shows and documentaries that Apple has planned. Of course, Carpool Karaoke, that was set for a May release and then an April one. And as you know, if you listened to the last MacCast, that has now been delayed until later this year. They're not ready to put that out. You also have Planet of the Apps, which is supposed to release sometime in the spring. That's going to be kind of a Shark Tank reality show with app developers trying to present their apps and get funding and get promotion from Apple on their apps. There's going to be a documentary about Clive Davis, and we just heard about one that's going to be about Bad Boy Records. Those are planned. Now, the Bloomberg piece says Apple could debut as many as 10 original shows and documentaries by the end of the year. So that's many more than we've heard about so far. So I would expect we might start to hear about some of those plans here in the near future. And then one other thing this week with respect to Apple Music. Apple supposedly did a deal with the music video app Musical.ly. That's Musical.ly to supply songs for their app. The app had been using, I believe, music licensed from an organization out of the UK. With this deal with Apple, now they're going to have access to the Apple Music Library. Right now, I'd never heard of this app before. Apparently, this is a kind of social app. It lets you create your own videos where you sing along to popular songs and then you can share them with your friends. It was actually fascinating. I saw some of the videos that were put together, and there's some pretty neat stuff that you can do with this app. I guess if you're into kind of lip syncing and performing, it's kind of a lip sync social sharing app. And they will switch to Apple Music coming this Friday. It's going to allow Apple Music subscribers to actually listen to and use full songs. Well, non-subscribers, it sounds like they're going to be able to listen to and get clips. And the Apple Music deal will let the app expand from exposure or from 30 countries to 120 countries, all the different countries that offer Apple Music. So that's going to be ultimately a good deal for the app. I'm not exactly sure what Apple gets out of it. I'm assuming exposure, obviously, tie-ins, and artists, I'm guessing, or record labels are going to get some revenue deal. So Apple's going to maybe have to pay out on that, or I guess I'm assuming Musical.ly actually pays Apple for the tracks, so maybe that covers some of their costs and they get some promotion out of it. So a lot of the details weren't given specifically in the article, but just another thing related to Apple Music that happened this week. I guess we knew it couldn't last forever. Max staying out of the malware spotlight was bound to change, especially as Apple has gained more in popularity, both on the Mac platform and on iOS. But specifically this week with the Mac, McAfee told us that Mac malware had grown by 744% since last year. Now, don't worry too much. Most of that is just adware. It's not a lot of big threats that are probably going to impact many people. But this week also brought word of a potentially very nasty malware called OS X Dock. I'm going to call it, say it's pronounced Dock, D-O-K. And I say nasty because the payload that this malware has comes via a signed, yes, a developer signed application. And to be fair, anyone with a Mac developer account can actually create a signed app. So you can sign up for the developer program, $99 a year, and you can build and start signing apps. You don't necessarily have to release them through the App Store, which would avoid them from going through a review. So this is something that could happen to any app, and or not to any app, but you could, you know, any app could be distributed like this, I guess is the point I'm trying to make. But the problem with this is that if you're using OS X and you have Gatekeeper enabled, this could potentially get through your Gatekeeper settings, assuming you don't have it set to the most restrictive option, which is only allow apps via the App Store. So this malware was not distributed through the Mac App Store. I want to make that very clear. But it would install on your Mac without any warnings if you had that middle setting to Gatekeeper, or of course, if you had it wide open, then all bets are off. But that said, there were a lot of warning signs that I think most savvy Mac users would have realized what was going on in terms of this getting installed on the Mac. So I have a feeling you as MacCast listeners would not have been infected by this, or would not get infected by this new malware, because it comes as a zip attachment on an email. So most of us know, don't open email attachments, right? But it's an email that looks like you have some sort of income tax issue. And this was really targeted at countries in Europe. You would have to actually open up this zip file, so unzip it, and run the attached document.app file. So it looks like an app, D-O-K-U-M-E-N-T. So I guess this was targeted at Germany specifically. But then once you run this, if you do end up running it, it actually does some pretty clever stuff. It installs itself as a startup item in your user account called App Store. So when you go to look at login items, you see App Store in there and think, hey, maybe nothing's wrong. Although it does have the preview icon on it. So that would be another kind of indicator that something's up with this little application. But then once it's running, it pops up a fake macOS update window saying you have an update. And that can't be bypassed actually until you enter your admin credentials. So it sort of blocks access to your Mac, another red flag that you can't close this window, you can't escape out of it, you can't quit it. And if you reboot your Mac because of that startup item, it just pops back up again. So if you go the step further and enter your admin credentials, of course, now it has the ability to have heightened installation access to your system, and it takes advantage of that to go ahead and use its software to configure and install a web proxy. So from this point forward, all of your web traffic is actually going to get routed through the attacker's web servers. And also it sets itself up with a fake security credential. So actually SSH, SSL traffic will go through that, and you won't see any red flags in your browser or even be alerted. So the idea here is that it looks like that what this thing is trying to do is actually monitor your web traffic, steal information. It also can start to then open up other access and controls and give, you know, potentially give hackers, you know, root access to your system. So basically at this point, you've been completely pwned. But if you get through all of those different things, I hate to be harsh about it, but you probably deserve to be pwned. And you know, I say that for us knowledgeable people, but I can see how someone less knowledgeable, less tech savvy might actually fall for this sort of thing. It could happen to them. So, of course, talk to your friends and family about this, about all the many warning signs, and also just about good practices, right? The things that we already know, I'll just reiterate them to kind of recap them. Never open attachments on an email that seems at the least, you know, seems the least bit suspicious, especially a zip file with some weird kind of application inside of it. You know, your tax authority is not going to ask you to do that. Never, ever run an app from an untrusted source. And I consider a random email that you get to your inbox a very untrusted source. You know, go to, if you think it's legit, go to the source website. You know, go to the government website and do some searching. Look around, see if they have a notice about this in, you know, maybe their news section or something like that. Suspect everything. You know, that's basically my tactic is I never believe it until I've proved it to myself through some other mechanism, you know, my own Google search. And that's just generally good advice. When in doubt, however small, stop and Google, you know, check it out. Almost all of the time, these kinds of attacks, these phishing schemes, they get figured out pretty quickly and people will post about them. So you can find information about them on Google. And really with this one, Apple has already, of course, revoked the developer certificate that was used to sign this thing. So from this point forward, that app will not run. It will not install. You'll not be able to actually use it. It will throw up a warning. It will tell you the certificate has been revoked, that it's invalid. So your chances of getting hit by this are pretty slim at this point. If you have it already, of course, you're going to want to make sure you get it off your system, and you could look for the warning signs, the document.app file. You can look in your startup items and see if you have a thing called App Store. All of these different things will give you an indication that maybe you've been hit by this. But again, I'm thinking MacCast listeners didn't get hit by this. The company Malwarebytes also did discover a second variant of this. It works in a lot of the same ways in terms of the installation package being the document.app, but it does not display the fake OS X update available window. What it actually does instead is it installs an open source backdoor program called Bella, which is a Python script that then attempts to do a number of things like expose your iMessage or monitor your iMessage and SMS chat messages. It does phishing for passwords. It gives remote shell access and screen sharing access to your system. Luckily, again, this variant uses the same developer certificate, signing certificate that Apple revoked. So again, this isn't going to be able to be installed from this point forward. But, you know, a lot of the core ideas that are in this malware are common ones that we see, and different components and things could start to resurface in other exploits and attacks. So it's good to be aware of this stuff. It's good to be vigilant. We need to be vigilant about these things. I still am of the mind that I don't think we need to install virus scanners. A lot of the stuff is kind of zero day, so it takes some time for that stuff to actually get into antivirus and anti-malware programs. So chances are they're not going to protect you right at day one. That's not saying they're not good. If you're really worried about it, go ahead and run a virus scanner. There's some great ones out there, and we've talked about a few on the MacCast. One thing that I do use and occasionally will run is the Malwarebytes software. I'll put a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com, but it's a good app that you can just scan every once in a while and look for any of those any of the 744% more possible adware programs that are out there. And they do have a free home version, so you can download this and run this. Again, it's not going to maybe necessarily find everything, but if you run it, you know, I try to run it every couple months or so just to make sure my system is clean, and it never finds anything. And that makes me feel good, and you know, just safe and protected. So that is one thing I would recommend doing. But again, just common sense. When something smells fishy, it is fishy, and you probably just want to throw it out. You know, so don't open those emails with weird attachments. This next story is something that many have been speculating about for a while, that Apple might use Siri to take on competitors in the home voice assistant space like Amazon Alexa and Google Home. This week, infamous Apple leaker Sonny Dixon says he thinks Apple could show off their Home Assistant offering at this June's WWDC, the Worldwide Developer Conference, and claims that Apple is currently actually finalizing their design. He claims it's going to be a cylindrical design, kind of inspired or looking like the trash can Mac Pro, including having kind of the concave top, which would have the controls inside of it. He says internally at Apple, it has the code name of B238. I don't know if that has any significance at all. It's just a general code name. I don't think it does. And the device will use, of course, Siri technology and have Apple Play support and include Beats speaker technology. So it's going to be kind of more like the higher end Amazon Echo with the speaker built in and all of the controls. Interestingly, the Sonny Dixon leak makes no mention of HomeKit, but I would assume that would be a big part of it as well and presumably come along for the ride just with the Siri integration. So maybe it's not even worth mentioning, or maybe it just seems too obvious, but it would be nice to have a unit that could sit and do your HomeKit stuff throughout the house using that kind of far field listening technology like the Amazon Echo uses. And as a matter of fact, Ming-Chi Kuo says the product has about a 50% chance of being announced at WWDC. And he says it will have excellent acoustic performance with one woofer and 7 tweeters and have computing power, he says, similar to the iPhone 6 or iPhone 6S, and would be positioned, of course, with all that great technology at the higher end of the market. And that would come along with kind of a higher end premium cost. So this isn't going to be a $49 device. I think more in that getting close to $200 range, I would imagine, coming in right around $199. I think the current Amazon Echo sells for around $179 US. So think about that price point. And I hope this is something that does come to be. A lot of us, I think, had sort of hoped it would be in the form of an updated Apple TV. This rumor doesn't seem to have any of that. This seems to be a separate standalone product that is going to be a home-based assistant product using Siri technology. So WWDC, June, maybe it'll happen. And then, as I said at the top of the show, we have a few odds and ends to cover this week. Apple's self-driving car that I told you about on the last episode of the MacCast that had come about through some of the approved permits in California. We got some details on that. Bloomberg actually posted some images of the vehicles on the roads in the Bay Area this week. As was specified in those permits, the cars are modified white Lexus RX 450H SUVs. The exterior of the vehicle has a variety of what appears to be just off-the-shelf different sensors, including Velodyne LiDAR, radar, and, of course, lots and lots of cameras. The nature of the vehicle and the test equipment kind of support this theory that Apple has transitioned away from trying to build their own autonomous vehicle and are focusing more on the software and the platform itself. Of course, no one got a look inside the vehicle, so who knows what's going on inside there. And another interesting thing potentially related to Apple's self-driving car efforts is that their partner in China, Didi Chung, or the company that ride-sharing company in China that Apple invested in, Didi Chung, they recently opened their own self-driving lab near Apple in California. And I have a feeling, again, I think I speculated at the time, I think a big part of Apple's investment in Didi Chung was about getting data, ride-sharing data and things like that. I still maintain that part of what Apple might be trying to do is build some sort of car as a service platform. So thinking in the future that many people won't even buy a car anymore, they'll just pay a monthly reoccurring fee to subscribe to an autonomous vehicle service. And I think it could be something that Apple could put together, and they could just use their platform installed in various OEM, you know, off the shelf kind of cars and build out a whole fleet and a service to actually service their customers. And I think that could be a really interesting thing. Now, another report says Apple has asked the California DMV to alter their rules that require it to publish detailed public reports on its self-driving car tests. So it's looking like Apple wants to do everything to kind of keep their plans secret. And I think that's only to be expected. You know, now they've got Bloomberg already posting images of these vehicles on the road. Who knows what's next? You know, if they have to turn that data of what they're doing over to the California DMV, of course, that would be public record. And, you know, news sites and things could get their hands on it and may be able to deduce more clearly exactly what Apple's trying to do. So, yeah, they want to keep that secret. That's not really surprising. If you're an Apple Watch, original Apple Watch, first generation Apple Watch owner, you're going to want to know about this. Apple has extended your Apple Care coverage for a swollen battery issue. It's not that a lot of the watches are having swollen battery problems, but some are. There have been some reported instances of batteries swelling up and basically the screen kind of becoming separated from the watch. That actually is a problem that is normally covered for most Apple products. Anything, any kind of Apple product with a swollen battery. A lot of people don't know this under Apple Care, for 2 years. Typically, for most parts and components, you get 1 year of standard coverage, and then if you invest in the additional coverage, it's going to cover you for 2 years. Swollen batteries are just covered 2 years by default. Apple has extended that coverage on first-generation Apple Watches out to 3 years, and it supposedly is in response to some users experiencing swollen battery issues with those models. So if you have that problem, or if you notice anything wonky with your display kind of starting to separate from the body of your first-gen Apple Watch, you're probably going to want to make a Genius Bar appointment pretty quick or actually call Apple. And I would think, you know, if you notice that too, you may not want to wear the Apple Watch. You know, that exploding on your wrist probably wouldn't be a very great thing. So get it into Apple quickly and they will definitely take care of that under warranty. Economic Times says Apple has plans to start selling the iPhone SE online in India ahead of them opening, ahead of them potentially opening stores in the region. Apple is supposedly starting with the iPhone SE because it's the only model that is being made in the country, which allows Apple to avoid the hefty import duties. Apple was working on bringing some production to India so that they could take advantage of that and also get the go-ahead to start opening retail locations, and that apparently has happened with the iPhone SE, and so they should begin selling those at least online here in the near future, and you can expect new retail locations to start opening up in India as well. So far, they've been relying on third-party resellers in that region, at least according to the stuff that I've been reading. So if you happen to be in that region, let us know what's happening with that. Kind of keep us on top of it. Shoot me some email, mattcast@gmail.com. And then finally, Apple store prices are going up, or app prices in the Apple store, or the App Store rather, are going up in Denmark, Mexico, and all territories that use the euro as currency. This is due to increases in foreign exchange rates, Apple kind of adjusting things around. So that's bad news if you're in one of those regions, I guess. But Apple did at least try to offer some relief on the lower priced products. Apparently, they've expanded the lower priced tier options to provide some alternates for developers to adjust their pricing if they want accordingly. So, for example, the price on an app that was selling for 0.99 euro, that price point was increased to 1.09 euro. Now, developers can also choose an alternative price tier of 0.99 euro, or Apple's also offering an even lower price point in the euro currency regions of 0.49 euro. So they can go even cheaper if they want. And apparently some developers, after the price increase happened, did start adjusting their prices. And it's also worth noting that the price increase did not affect auto renewable subscription prices. So if you had an app that was using a subscription price or something like Netflix, that price point did not get adjusted up. So you're going to be continuing to pay the existing price point that you were before the changes went into effect. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Bitbucket. Let's be honest, your code, if you're a developer, is your world. You create it, you tweak it, you lovingly obsess over it, especially if you're like me, every day. And so picking the right repository management tool is super important. Only the best for your code, right? That's why the team at Atlassian created Bitbucket. Bitbucket is the Git solution for professional teams, helping over 5 million developers build with a purpose. Bitbucket gives teams of all sizes free private repositories with state-of-the-art features like the world's best pull request algorithm, built-in continuous delivery, and integrations with your favorite tools like Docker, Amazon Web Services, and Azure. And because Bitbucket comes from Atlassian, it offers the best Jira integration available, giving your team everything you need to take your code from concept to customer. I've used Bitbucket on several projects that I've done for clients, and it really helped keep the team and the code organized and secure, helped keep the project on track, and I loved how easy it was to set things up and the ability to actually integrate with Amazon Web Services, which was a key part of this project, made everything go very, very smoothly. And plus, they've put in some really unique features like branch permissions that let you control who on your team can perform what actions on a branch type, or any kind of based on any kind of branch pattern. So that's a unique feature that can be really helpful in a lot of scenarios. Bitbucket is for the code that takes us to Mars, it decodes the human genome, or drives your next car. And if you visit bitbucket.org/forthecode, you can start a free trial account right now. It will let you use Bitbucket for small teams of up to 5 people completely free, no credit card needed, so there's no point in not trying it out. You should try it out now. That's bitbucket.org/forthecode. Try Bitbucket today. What will your code do? And a big thank you to Bitbucket and Atlassian for their support of the MacCast. Now we return to our Scooby-Doo mystery, the mysterious case of the moving location data. And no, it wasn't the janitor, Jim Perkins, who caused the data movement. I would have got away with it, too, if it weren't for those darn kids. No, that's not what's going on. Last week, I told you about the listener who was at an NBA playoff game at a stadium in Indianapolis and was taking photos and then noticed that the photos were tagged with location data that was for the visiting team's stadium. And it was a bit of a mystery, you know, sort of what was going on there. And I threw out my theory to you that what I think happened was you're in a stadium, giant metal domed structure, and basically, cellular signals and GPS signals, those are all but blocked, which means that for location data, the iPhone's going to have to default back to Wi-Fi location data. And if you know a little bit about how that works, basically, the IP addresses for different Wi-Fi hotspots are in a location database. And there's a couple different companies that maintain and keep hold of these databases, and they basically try to map specific IPs from ISPs or different devices to different locations. And those don't get updated all that frequently. And if you're just looking at an IP address, you don't know if the physical thing that's attached to that IP address has moved or not. So if a base station router moves, or if that access point moves from one location to another, it's going to still report the old location in that database. So my theory was that because it was playoff games, there were probably some fans from the visiting teams area. They came in and maybe on their devices or phones had Wi-Fi hotspots enabled and locally assigned IP addresses that would trace them back to their hometown, which in this case was Cleveland. So that, you know, our listeners' phone. He was in Indianapolis and had never been to Cleveland, but it was globbing onto a Wi-Fi access point that was basically saying, hey, I'm in Cleveland. And so that was my theory, but I did throw it out to you and I asked for other theories. And overwhelmingly, I got responses back that said, yes, you know, we think this is a Wi-Fi location thing, but we don't think, Adam, your theory about it being a Wi-Fi hotspot on a fan's phone is the right thing. What we think is probably going on, and I heard this from many people, we think that maybe the visiting team brought their own Wi-Fi equipment and basically their own network because they want to attach to something that they know is secure, that no one's snooping in on, and they have control of. So they brought that equipment from the home stadium, hooked that up, and that was probably the Wi-Fi that your guy was globbing onto. Now, I don't know where his seats were, so I could buy that if maybe he was down on the floor near the team. But, I mean, a stadium is a huge place. And there is one other thing that makes me think that maybe that's not the case, because I buy the theory and logic. It makes perfect sense that that could be what was going on. But, and here's the big but, here's the exception. I got an email from Kurt, who was at the same exact stadium, Bankers Life Fieldhouse Stadium in Indianapolis. Thing was, is he wasn't there for a basketball game. He was there for a concert recently. And his photo data, when he started taking photos, started showing the wrong location. Guess what? His were showing that his photos were taken at the Marcus Amphitheater in Milwaukee, not Cleveland. Remember the NBA story, the GPS were reporting Cleveland. So what's going on here? Well, he said in his email that the location, the Marcus Amphitheater in Milwaukee, was where the band had been the night before. And I know that fans follow bands around from venue to venue. So I'm back to my theory being the one that might be correct. Now, I guess it's possible that the band also is like traveling with their own Wi-Fi network. Is that something bands do? I don't know. I'm not in a successful touring rock band. Maybe it's something that happens these days. But who really knows? The one thing tip that Kurt did point out was he was able to quickly fix his issue at the venue simply by restarting his iPhone. So when he noticed it was the wrong location data, he did a restart of his iPhone right when he was there, and that resolved and fixed the issue. So I'm assuming it, you know, reconnects to the cellular data network and then can kind of figure out, okay, you're not in Milwaukee, you're actually in Indianapolis. So give that a try if you've been running into that trouble. And so I guess it's possible, you know, the other theory, and I'm still open to even more. I still haven't heard from a Wi-Fi cellular, you know, GPS engineer. So if you're out there and you exist and you know exactly what's going on, let us know. You may also be thinking, well, why do we even care about this? Like, big deal, you know, occasionally our photos are going to have the wrong geotag data on them. And is it really that big of a deal, especially if we can go in and just adjust that in our apps and sort of correct it and fix it? And I've done this for some of my own photos. I think I mentioned last time that occasionally photos that even that I've taken at my house are showing up at a location that's about 15, 20 miles actually away from where I am. And so I think it comes down to is like, why is this happening? Do we even care? And I think we do, because this problem actually comes up in some other situations. Specifically, one that I think is really confusing for people is when you have devices like an Apple TV or a Mac that doesn't have a GPS built into it and actually has to rely on Wi-Fi location data. Now that Apple is really recommending, and actually I recommend, most people are recommending, that we use two-factor authentication, right? And the way Apple has implemented two-factor authentication is that when you attempt to log in from a device or a Mac or something like that, all of your other devices that are enabled with the two-factor receive a notification message. And in that notification message, it lists a location and it says, hey, we've just received an alert that a device is attempting to log in from this location. And if that location is inaccurate or way off, that can be particularly confusing. And a lot of times what's happening is if it's an Apple TV or a Mac, it's connected to your home network, it's connected to your ISP, but I've noticed it's reporting the location of wherever the home office for your ISP is. So, you know, if you're, in my example, Cox, and I have a feeling that's what's going on with some of my photo data when I'm at home, that I'm connected to my home Wi-Fi network, and for whatever reason, it's not using the GPS in my device. It's actually using the Wi-Fi information. It's coming up completely wrong. And so it crops up, especially in families where you have an account that might be shared. And I've heard of scenarios where a wife or a husband or a kid's trying to log in and they might just be in another part of the house. And then suddenly someone else gets a notification alert that says someone's trying to log into your iTunes or your iCloud account from a location 20 miles away. Is this okay? And you like, no, deny it. And then the person can't log in. So it becomes a problem. So it's good for us to be aware that, you know, like GPS, especially when it comes to Wi-Fi location GPS, can sometimes be way off. And maybe before completely denying it, you want to check with your other family members and just make sure they're not trying to log into your Wi-Fi network. So I don't know if we've solved the mysterious case of the moving, you know, photo location data, but at least we have some, I think, pretty good theories going. And again, I'm open to hearing more. And specifically, if you're kind of an expert in this field, I'd love to hear from you. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Staying on the topic of two-factor authentication and Apple TV for a moment, if you've ever enabled two-factor authentication for your Apple ID, and like I said, you should, you might know that some older devices and older versions of the operating system may or may not support two-factor authentication, which is Apple's kind of latest version. They also did a two-step verification that worked on older devices. But if you have an older Apple TV, specifically like an Apple TV 2, this can potentially pose a problem. And actually, this is something that Paul ran into, and he had a little tip on how you might work around it.
Hi, Adam. It's Paul here again from the UK. A tip maybe for other listeners, something that happened to me just recently. I have an Apple TV. It's the second generation, but it does everything I want to do or want it to do. So I don't see any point in going out and buying the latest and greatest because it still works. However, after your couple of programs on security, I turned on two-factor authentication, and when I came to use the remote app on my iPhone 7, I couldn't log in because the two-factor authentication was preventing me from putting in my password on the second generation Apple TV. It was asking for the 6-digit code and there was nowhere to put the code. Some Google posts suggested that you put the code at the end of your password, but that didn't seem to work. So I got around it by creating a new Apple ID, and one that I signed into iTunes with and attached a credit card to. Still mine, but not my main one. And I didn't activate two-factor authentication on that particular one. And I have a credit card attached to that, which is what I call a dummy card. So I just put a bit of money on it here and there to cover any costs of apps or movies or what have you. So if it was ever compromised, there would be very little money in there. And then I added it to family sharing. So there was a connection between my normal account and the new account. And I then signed into Apple TV with that new Apple ID and downloaded the iTunes remote onto my iPhone and signed in again and again with the home sharing. I signed up to home sharing with that new Apple ID, and Bob's your uncle, everything works absolutely fine. So Apple's technical guy, his suggestion was I went out and bought a brand new Apple TV, but my solution, I think, is probably A, keeps Apple Kit going for longer, B, was cheaper, and C, if it ain't broken, why mend it? Still listening to your show, brilliant show, and thanks very much for that. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks, Paul. I appreciate your tip. That's a very, very clever workaround and a very good way that you could potentially continue to use your older devices for a bit longer. And I'm always a big fan of doing that. I have a lot of older devices around here. I actually have an Apple TV 2 and I take it on the road, although I don't think I've tried to use it since setting up two-factor authentication. So I may run into this problem. I did want to comment on one thing about adding the six-digit code to the end of your password to kind of work around this. This is actually something apparently you can do on a number of older devices once you've enabled two-factor authentication. And our friend Allison Sheridan over at the NoSillaCast podcast actually ran into this same thing with her Apple TV 2, and she actually did get the six-digit code thing to work. But what she realized, and I think this is what might have been happening to you, so you may give this a try again, is that it could simply be a timing thing. Those six-digit codes, I think they have a pretty quick timeout. I want to say the two-factor authentication codes maybe live for about 30 to 60 seconds, maybe a little bit longer than that. And if you have a particularly long or difficult password to type into your Apple TV, especially with that little silver remote, it can take a really long time to type just the base password. And by the time you get to adding the six-digit code on the end of it, chances are it may have already invalidated or timed out that code. So you have to kind of try and log in before that happens. And the way this works apparently is you'll have to try to log in to the Apple TV the first time and let it fail. Because I think at that point, that with the older device will then trigger the two-factor authentication alert to pop up onto your other devices. So at that point, it's going to pop up. It's going to do the location thing like we were talking about earlier, saying, hey, something's trying to log into your account from this location. Do you want to allow it? At this point, don't hit the allow option right away. Leave it up on the screen with the six-digit code ready to go. Then start typing in your password on the Apple TV using the remote. And once you get the password totally typed in, don't hit enter or go yet because you need to still add the six-digit code. Then tap the allow option. And when you hit allow on that location thing, that's the thing that will generate the code and then send it to your device. So then when the code pops up, you're ready to go with the Apple TV. All you have to do is type in the six-digit code, then hit login. And at that point, it should work. You should be able to get logged into your device. And it should happen quickly enough that the code's not going to expire on you. And that should let you into your older Apple TV. So I would say give that a try. And hopefully that's a tip that helps some of you out there as well. And just in general, the other tip of, and Apple mentions this, but you have to really read into the documentation, that general tip of if you have an older device and you have two-factor authentication turned on, try appending that little six-digit code to the end of the password, and it probably will work in most scenarios. I don't think all scenarios, but in most scenarios. So thanks for sending in your tip, Paul, and kind of getting the conversation going on this one. Now I want to talk to you about a little bit of a deceptive practice or bad advice being given out at the Genius Bar. David wrote in this week to tell me about a generally positive experience he had with Apple support. As you know, here on the MacCast, we're big fans of positive Apple support, Apple Genius Bar appointments and stories and resolutions to tech problems and stuff like that. But in his specific case, David had an iMac that was about 60 days out of its AppleCare warranty, and unfortunately, the logic board failed. And he had not purchased the extended AppleCare for this iMac, so it was the original one-year warranty. And he went in just to the Genius Bar to find out what his options were, and they told him the logic board replacement was going to cost about $600 US. And that he could try to call AppleCare directly and see if they would offer him a discount on that repair, that he may be able to get some money off of that repair. And I think that's fine and good advice. But after that, it got a little bit weird with the Genius, because that Genius also, quote unquote, advised him to, quote, make up a good story about why he was 60 days past his warranty period. And he even gave him some specific examples, like saying, you know, tell them you were traveling, you were out of the country when the warranty was up and you just returned back and realized you had this problem. Or tell them you were dealing with a sick family member and hadn't really been paying attention and you just kind of missed the date. So basically telling him to lie to AppleCare support. And David, being an honest person and a listener of the MacCast, you've probably heard me always say your best tactic is to be completely honest with the Genius Bar people, with the AppleCare people, and not try to make up stories like this. So David did not take this bit of advice. He did take the advice of calling up AppleCare support and asking them, you know, hey, can you give me kind of a break on this logic board repair? And they did say that they would do that for him. They said, you know, we'll give you a discount. Unfortunately, you're going to have to go back to the Apple Store to actually get the discount applied, something about their system. I don't really know how that works with Apple. But when he did make another Genius Bar appointment and go back, they had all of the notes in there saying that, yes, he would be offered a discount, but there was some kind of discrepancy there as well. And ultimately, the Genius of the Genius Bar just opted to cover the entire repair for free. So that was what ended up with David being very pleased about the final result of his Genius Bar appointment, because he got his logic board replaced. He was out of warranty and he didn't have to pay a dime for it, which is great. I mean, that's great customer service. That's the way it should happen. Great story. But again, what really bothered me about this one was the advice of the Genius to directly lie to AppleCare support. And it bothers me most because David's story isn't the only story that I've heard of this. I've been hearing this more and more of geniuses actually recommending that people lie basically to get better service or out of warranty repairs. I have a theory kind of as to why this might be happening. And I think it's because Apple has been slowly, Apple Corporate, you know, the main organization, has kind of been tightening the reins, or I've heard on several occasions and from several, I think, trusted sources, that they are removing the discretion of geniuses. It used to be in the past when you go in for a Genius Bar appointment at the retail store, the geniuses had a certain amount of discretion to kind of decide to cover or not cover certain kinds of repairs, out of warranty repairs, depending upon your story, the situation, what was going on. They had a little bit of leeway. That's been getting tighter and tighter. Apple's been kind of restricting that. And I think as a reaction, the geniuses, who they're nice people. And I don't think this guy who was telling him, you know, to kind of make up a story for AppleCare, I don't think he was trying to be nefarious or do anything, you know, that he considered to be really wrong. I think in his mind, he was thinking, I'm going to help this guy out. I feel bad for him. I feel bad for his scenario. He's just barely out of warranty. I want to help him out, but my hands are tied. So this way I know, you know, he can maybe get a discount or get some money off of this repair. And this is, he was trying to give him, you know, advice, what I consider to be bad advice, on doing that. And so my theory is, because Apple's been tightening, you know, the geniuses want to be helpful and they think they're doing a good thing. And ultimately, I'm not a big fan of dishonesty, so it just kind of comes down to that for me. And I've actually experienced this firsthand when I had a small crack in my iPhone screen. I actually dropped it, and I had this teeny tiny crack on the edge. But I knew I had AppleCare. I knew I had the accidental warranty coverage, and I just went into the Apple Store and to ask them to fix the screen for me under the accidental warranty. And while I was there, the genius that I was working with actually hinted very strongly that if I would just confirm that the screen just magically cracked on its own, that, you know, they could do the repairs at no cost. He was basically saying, so what you're saying is, you know, it just suddenly cracked, right? And I said, no, I actually dropped it. And he said, you mean it just kind of cracked on its own, right? You know, hint, hint, nudge, nudge. And, you know, ultimately I paid for the repair, because it was me causing the damage, and that's kind of the rules, and I like to play by the rules. So again, this has been happening more and more. I'd be curious if you've experienced this as well, and maybe hearing some more of these stories. And I wish it wasn't the case. You know, I wish Apple would go back to the days when they kind of just put the customer in the situation first. I'm not implying that they have to do every repair at cost and they have to go outside of their AppleCare warranty, you know, but I think it was nice when they let the retail locations kind of assess and decide, because they're hearing the story, they're seeing what's going on the front lines, and just sort of setting hard corporate policies. I think doesn't lead to as good of a customer service experience. And we've been kind of hearing that and feeling that. I've heard a lot fewer of the really positive stories and more of the I'm somewhat frustrated stories. And ultimately, I get good service, but you kind of have to push for it and you have to kind of demand it and ask for it. It's not just something that naturally happens anymore. And I do think that's because of changing policies at Apple Retail, at least from what I've been hearing. And occasionally I'll hear somebody chime in, one of my sources will chime in and say, no, that's not the case. But by and large, and there's a lot of retail stores out there, so I get a lot of different stories, that's kind of the story I've been hearing. So just be aware of that. And please, you know, despite what a genius of the genius Mar might tell you in terms of telling a little white lie, you know, be honest and upfront, just straightforward. And I've always found that that's the best policy. And almost every time I get really great service from Apple doing that. So that would be my advice. Another recent topic we've been having here on the MacCast, of course, is the rumor that the next generation iPhone may be getting wireless charging. And various members of the community have differing opinions on the benefits or not benefits of Apple actually adding wireless charging. I've weighed in a little bit. I really don't see much of a difference, especially if it's the kind of, you know, what they call contactless, but basically contact charging where you have to put it on a special pad or in a special location to actually get wireless charging. I don't really see that all that different as having to put my iPhone in a lightning dock or plug a cable into it. You know, it's really not that big a deal. But if it's an option, you know, I'm kind of okay with it. And it's sounding like that's how it's going to be implemented. You have this option of, you know, wireless charging or cable charging, and cable charging is probably going to work faster, but maybe in some scenarios, the lightning or the wireless charging is going to be a little bit more convenient. You know, you can just throw your iPhone down on your nightstand at the end of the day if you've got the pad in the right location, and it's going to charge up, and you don't really have to worry about it. So, you know, save a few milliseconds here and there. And some people seem to be, you know, very open to that idea. And Jason actually wrote in to tell me that he was a fan of the idea because he said he started having issues with the Lightning connector on his iPhone 6, really not making a secure connection, that it was kind of wobbly and it wasn't really making a secure connection. So to not have to rely on that, to just have something that was wireless and not have the cable falling out and, you know, thinking that you plugged it in and it was working and it turns out it wasn't charging and you have a dead phone in the morning, that sounded like, you know, a good thing to him. And, you know, I kind of said back to him, do you really think it's the connector wearing out? Because that was kind of his theory, that the constant plugging and unplugging had kind of worn out the little bit that kind of locks the lightning cable into place. It kind of has, I think there's like little spring clips or something in there that kind of, you know, seal the deal. So when you put it in there, it holds it tight and makes sure that the lightning cable just doesn't fall out if you pick up the phone and you're using it or something like that while it's plugged in. And he said, yeah, I'm pretty sure, you know, I've tried different cables. It's not just that, because I actually have had some cables fail in really weird ways. Like some of my Amazon Basics cables, one of the little pins actually just fell out of, you know, one side of the lightning connector. So that cable that I have, and it's a made for iPhone cable. It only works when you plug it in one direction and not the other direction. You have to kind of look and you can see the little missing bit of copper that just sort of popped out of the little area there. But he said, no, that wasn't the case. And he ultimately, you know, took the phone into Apple to have it looked at. I had said, well, you might want to just have Apple check it out and see what they say about possibly fixing it. And it turned out his problem was actually bunnies, dust bunnies. The lightning port, he sent me a picture. It had just this wad of, you know, lint and kind of fuzz dust jammed at the bottom. And it kind of makes sense. You know, if you're like me, you stick your phone in your pocket and your pockets have lint. And I don't think Jason's alone in having a dirty lightning port. I think it's something, and I know, as a matter of fact, because I've cleaned out lightning ports on my own phones. I've rousted many a dust bunny out of the lightning port on my phone. And typically the way I do it, and I'm not advising or saying this is the best way to do it, but typically the way I do it is I kind of gently work it out with a, you know, just a simple wooden toothpick. You know, I don't know if that's the best implement for the job. I kind of figure it's non-conductive are not too conductive. I guess wet wood could maybe be conductive, but it's not a toothpick that I've used. It's a fresh toothpick out of the box, and I very carefully, gingerly, you know, don't jam it in there and like rub it around and, you know, like be scraping things, but just kind of put it in there and kind of pull little bits of fuzz and lint out of there. And I've gotten some considerable amounts of dust and junk out of my lightning port. Maybe a plastic toothpick would be better, some kind of implement like that. But again, something soft and gentle, something that's not going to really crank down or harp on the lightning connectors that are in there. They're kind of flat, so I'm not sure if there's much damage you could do in there. And as far as I know, the lightning port is almost completely sealed up, so you're not going to be poking into anything weird. But be gentle. Avoid pressing too hard. Avoid breaking the tip off of the wooden toothpick, because you wouldn't want that to get kind of stuck in down in your port there. But I feel like we've discussed this in the past a long time ago, but I think it's worth repeating. You know, you may have to clean your lightning cable out. And Jason said the genius told him, you know, basically, if you're looking at the lightning cable going into the bottom of your phone, when it's all the way in, if it's a made for iPhone lightning cable, that cable should fit flush with the bottom of your phone. You shouldn't see any of the metal connector sticking out. And if you do, if there's a slight gap there, even the slightest bit of gap, then chances are it's rabbit season. You've got a dust bunny in there, and you probably need to clear that out. So clean your lightning ports, people, especially if you've been noticing that you're having like connectivity issues. Or another common one that happens to me is you plug the lightning cable in, and if you're using the device and it suddenly is, you know, doing the on-off thing, like it's making the I'm charging noise and then it turns off and aren't charging noise again. Sometimes that can be a sign of a cracked cable or just a bad cable, but also it just may be that your lightning connector is wobbling around a little bit because you've got something blocking making a flush good connection. So check that out. And Jason, thanks for sharing your story with us so we could talk about this a little bit. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me your emails, your audio comments to MacCast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Or if you prefer to use Skype, you can leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype username is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com, and while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me between shows on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. You can find that by going to google.com/plusmaccast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.